Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Admiralty when we come back. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we're talking to the police or government agents, and that is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to is summed up in this maxim of law, which says all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Listen to this first judge. He said, who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights? And he said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. Now, you know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester, wouldn't I? Now, listen to the second judge. He said, you can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment. That's in Belknap versus United States. Now, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. Now, listen to the third judge. Here's what he said. He said the constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted. That comes from Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for that free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, informative, and free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, talking about admiralty last time, I said admiralty law encompasses all of the controversies arising out of acts done upon or relating to the sea and questions of prize. So last time we talked about a couple of prize actions. Prize is that law dealing with war and the spoils of war, such as capture of ships, goods, materials, and property, both real and personal. You ever stop to think about what an admiralty prize is on Highway 44? Or what a admiralty prize or an admiralty prize is in Baltimore, Maryland, when the state seizes a man's paycheck? Admiralty prizes. Maritime causes is that system of law which relates to commerce. I always underline the word commerce. It relates to commerce, navigation, and controversies arising from maritime ventures, which are adjudicated in the admiralty courts. However, a person need not be on a ship at sea to be under admiralty jurisdiction. This jurisdiction can attach merely because the subject matter falls within the scope of maritime law, such as the use of bills, notes, checks, and credit, which all fall under this jurisdiction, such as credit cards and checks and Federal Reserve notes and mortgages. Admiralty law grew and developed from the harsh realities and expedient measures required to survive at sea. It was very extensive jurisdiction of maritime cases and has both a civil and criminal jurisdiction. Because of its genesis, it retains and contains a harsh set of rules and procedures where there is no right to privacy and there is no right to a trial by jury. In fact, there are no rights under any civil law jurisdiction, only privileges granted by the captain of the maritime venture. George Bush is that captain. George Bush is the captain of the great ship America on a maritime adventure, practicing the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto under admiralty. Well, what a revolting development this has turned out to be, as old William Bendix used to say. Now, if you want an example, in this jurisdiction, admiralty, there's no such thing as a right not to be compelled to testify against yourself in a criminal case. However, the captain can, if he wishes, grant the privilege against self-incrimination. And there's no such thing as a right to use your property on the public rivers of tar, the highways, but the captain can grant you a privilege to do so. And there is no such thing as a right to operate a public business, only a privilege allowed so long as you perform according to the captain's rules and regulations. Maritime law is nearly as old as the common law, and it existed parallel with the common law in England and in Europe, where the Roman civil law was practiced. It is this admiralty maritime jurisdiction of the civil law that has been foisted off on all of us. This civil law is the law of the ruler. This, while the common law is the law of the people. Unknowingly, the people of America and the people of Western Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand have been cunningly coerced out of their common law rights and forced into this admiralty jurisdiction and into these admiralty courts. Government has corrupted equity law as well, which has had the effect of denying us or making it almost impossible to exercise our inalienable constitutional substantive common law rights. This admiralty maritime jurisdiction is located under Article 3, Section 2 of our federal constitution, and we'll address it a little more a little later. Limited liability. Limited liability is insurance. It's the exact opposite of strict liability. God, in the Bible, demands that we practice strict liability. We don't want to practice strict liability. We want to practice limited liability because we don't want to be responsible for our actions. For instance, let's suppose you're driving your car down the road and you have an accident. It costs $100,000 and it's your fault. You don't want to pay that $100,000. You're happy to pay $500 a year in premium to the insurance company. If you have the accident, you become the winner. You become the winner in a bet. You're betting, in effect, I'm going to have an accident that's going to cost $100,000. The insurance company comes back and says, well, we bet you're not going to have an accident costing $100,000. And if you do, we will pay for that accident, plus the cost of litigation. So you go out there, and sure enough, you have an accident, costs $100,000, and you collect how many of those accidents occur. Well, the insurance company's not dumb. You know, they go out and they figure out how often accidents occur. And here in the United States, every driver is expected to have, statistically, one accident every 32 years, which costs $1,835 to repair. Now, boys and girls, you figure out how many accidents you've had in the past, how much is your insurance bill today, and have you paid more in premiums than you have collected in benefits? I've asked that question probably 1,000 times over the years, and I have yet to find one person who has collected more in benefits than he has paid out in premiums. Not one, not yet. That's exactly correct. Now, you people have been propagandized into believing that, oh my God, I wouldn't dare live a day of my life without insurance. Now, have you? Let's try it. Let's take your house. You got fire insurance on your house? How much does that cost? $200-$300 a year? $500 a year? When was the last time your house burned to the ground? When was the last time you had a fire in your house? When was the last time the fire department came out to your property and put a fire out? Never? That's about right. I checked this out one time up in Boise, Idaho, and I called the fire department. I said, listen, and I'd like to know when the last time a house burned to the ground here in Boise, Idaho. They looked up their records, and it was 1957. That was in 83 when I asked the question, 57, 67, 77, 25 years. Now, I lived at 1205 North Roosevelt Street, so there was a fire department down on Americana, there was another fire department up on Orchard, and one out on Fairview. There's three fire departments within 6 or 8 blocks of my house. And I was supposed to have fire insurance on my house. No, I didn't, because I woke up to this insurance thing. I used to have insurance. I'm not telling you I'm Lily White here. I used to buy insurance because I was told to. But I never collected on my insurance. And a couple, three times when I had a claim and I went down and said, hey, now pay me, they didn't want to pay me. Oh, they just fought like tigers not to pay. I thought, well, that's kind of funny. I thought these guys were kind of like Las Vegas. You know, when you win the slot machine, they can turn on the bells and whistles and jump up and down, smile, take your picture and say, hey, look at this guy won. I thought they'd do that with me with the insurance company. They didn't. And so I learned early on that if you have a claim, you'll have to sue them to collect. Well, unless it's, you know, something kind of minor and to their advantage to pay off so that you don't sue them for more. Well, in Exodus chapter 21 or 22, I think it's 21, verse 28, there's a story in there about a guy that's got a bull, you know, and this bull goes down the road and it causes some damage. And God says, well, now you got to pay for that damage. So some entrepreneur comes along and says, now, hasn't God required that you pay for all of the damages that you cause? And you say, yay, Lord, God has required that we pay all of our damages. And isn't this onerous and unfair that God would require you to pay damages, which would, in some cases, amount to more than you have to pay? Yes, it is onerous, and it's unfair that God would require us to pay damages that could in some cases be more than we have to pay. Now that we've established that God is unfair, now we can make the pitch. Well, then, to get around this harsh Old Testament God who's unfair and unrealistic and requires that you pay more than you have, we have insurance where you just pay a small portion. So you don't have to put up the whole $100,000, you just put up $500 a year for the next 200 years. Ain't that just real special? Now, in Boise, Idaho, there's about 105,000 people living there in 1983. I figured four people to a house, so there's probably 25,000 houses. The last one burned to the ground in 1957. Not very good odds that your house is going to burn to the ground. And yet they require on a $100,000 house, $100,000 worth of coverage. Now, the average fire only costs $14,000 in those days. It's called a kitchen grease fire. And if your kitchen catches on fire, you're going to have a $14,000 damage. So common sense would say insure your place for $14,000. But if you do that, there's a clause in the contract that says if the house isn't fully insured, the insurance company will only pay the prorated amount of the insurance purchased. So if you've got a $100,000 house and you're buying $14,000 worth of insurance, and you have a kitchen grease fire, and it costs $14,000, the insurance company will not pay you $14,000, they will pay you $1,400. And that's because you only had your house insured for about 10% of its value. That's to keep the stream of revenue high in the insurance company. Now, the insurance company works with the banks and with your state government. And in the case of state government, they require all drivers to have insurance, liability insurance. Of course, they give you freedom here. You've got to have freedom. This is America. We have to have our freedom in America. You can buy this insurance, which is mandated by law, from any insurance company you want. Isn't that just real special? I thought you'd love that. And if, you know, if the insurance company, if government and the insurance companies can get together and compel you to buy life insurance, they can compel you to buy television sets and carpet, or compel you to buy anything they want, can't they? Think about it. If government can compel you to buy auto insurance, why can't they compel you to buy health insurance, fire insurance, bowling balls, carpet, drapes, furniture, automobiles? Now, boys and girls, you don't live in the land of the free and the home of the brave. You live in the land of admiralty, where the captain decides, that is, your guardian decides for you what's good for you. And you've agreed to that in advance. And that's kind of like joining the army. Now, once you join the army, that's a voluntary action, joining the army. But what goes on after you join the army is mandatory. Joining Social Security and getting your Seaman's papers, that was voluntary. What goes on after you've made this voluntary contract, now that's mandatory. Mandatory. Now, in the case called the New Jersey Steam Navigation Company versus Merchants Bank, cited at 6 Howard 342, back in 1848, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that under the common law, ship owners were liable for the acts of their ship masters. In other words, if a party were to ship goods on board a ship, and something happened to the goods, such as being destroyed or damaged by the perils of the sea, the ship owner was responsible to the owner of the goods. Yep. The ship owner must pay to the owner of the goods the amount the goods were worth. So if the ship owner didn't pay the debt, the owner of the goods could sue the ship owner and collect. If the ship owner failed to pay, the creditor could then file a lien on the ship, which was called a maritime lien, and which does not require possession of the object. And that old common law rule comes from the old covenant, Exodus 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. Series of statutes in there that tell you that if somebody gives you his goods and they be lost or stolen, then you're to take an oath between him and yourself that you didn't put your hand into his goods, and then you wouldn't have to make it good. So this wasn't exactly under the rules of the common law true, accurate, and correct. But it's fairly correct, because if you deliver goods to me and I'm careless with them and I lose them because of my bad seamanship and the ship sinks and your goods go down with it, then I've got to compensate you. So the ship owner said, well, we don't want to be responsible for the goods that we're transporting on our ships. So they went to Congress, which is what lobbyists do today. They go to Congress for the pharmaceutical industry, and they say, we don't want to be sued for the vaccine, excuse me, the vaccines that we produce. So Dick Armey, he goes in and he puts this rider on a bill. And if your kid gets shot up with snake venom and monkey pus and it causes autism and you want to sue the pharmaceutical company, you can't do that. They're protected. And that's what the Limited Liability Act of 1851 did. It protected the ship owners from their carelessness or their liability to their shippers, just like the pharmaceutical companies wanted to be protected from lawsuits. And they are. Now, so Congress decided in 1851 that as a result of the New Jersey steam navigation case, persons would no longer be drawn into ownership of ships because of the liability involved. And shipping on the high seas is very risky, and it was especially so at that period in history. In addition, shipping was the only means of commerce, and the above decision would drastically reduce commerce within the United States. Now, commerce is where government makes all of its money. In fact, in those days, we made our money by impost and export taxes, import and export taxes. So when countries wanted to come into the United States, and if they wanted to sell their goods over here, they had to pay tax. We financed our government in that manner. And so the Congress, you know, they're sitting there thinking, well, you know, nothing personal here, but you know, we've got money involved. And you can bet that the insurance companies were there lobbying and taking them out to lunch and dinner and paying their expenses and paying for their motels and hotels and, you know, just like bribers and bribe takers do today. So as a result, Congress enacted the Limited Liability Act, codified at 46 U.S.C. 181, as amended in 1875, 1877, 1935, and 36, and also the Act of 1884, which covered the entire subject of limitations. Now, the purpose of this act was to limit the liability for the payment of debts of persons who were ship owners involved in maritime commerce. The act specifically gives limited liability on shipments of bills of any bank or public body. After the Limited Liability Act was enacted in 1889, the U.S. Supreme Court in Butler versus Boston and Savannah Steamship Company ruled as follows. They said, quote, "But it is enough to say that the rule of limited responsibility is now our maritime rule. It is the rule by which, through the Act of Congress, we have announced that we propose to administer justice in maritime cases. The rule of limited liability prescribed by the Act of 1851 is nothing more than the old maritime rule administered in courts of admiralty in all countries except England from time immemorial. And if this were not so, the subject matter itself is one that belongs to the Department of Maritime Law." So our Supreme Court said, hey, you know, going clear back into Roman times, for crying out loud, we practiced limited liability. But boys and girls, limited liability is a religious ideology that comes from the Babylonian mystery religion and the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans. It doesn't come from God. You didn't get insurance from God and Moses at Mount Sinai. You got strict liability from God. And you woke up one day and said, oh, no, we're not going to practice strict liability. We're going to practice limited liability. Okay. So you people down on the Gulf Coast, you bought this hurricane insurance, remember? And then you had a hurricane called Katrina. Do you remember? And then this tidal surge came in and washed your houses away. Do you remember? And you didn't have flood insurance. Do you remember? And the insurance company says, we ain't paying. We collected your premiums for 20 years, but we ain't paying because you didn't have flood insurance and you had a flood. That's what destroyed your house. Now, boys and girls, you said you wanted limited liability. You said you wanted to play the game of limited liability. You said, I would rather play the game of limited liability with Mutual of Omaha than to practice strict liability with the creator of the universe. Okay, so now you got limited liability with Mutual of Omaha. You got to pay your premiums, and now they won't pay you. How do you like it? It's called admiralty, and you can go sue them if you want, but you'll probably lose. Isn't that just real special? Now, that's why I've said, you know, for years, I'm not complaining about limited liability. It's a choice that I have to make. I've got to choose whether I want to buy health insurance or not. So I chose not to buy health insurance. Now, health insurance costs us about $9,000 a year. That's $9,300 was the last number that I saw on that. $9,300 a year times 20 years. That's $186,000. $186,000 over 20 years. And you people have been paying this $9,000. Well, maybe you haven't been paying it, but your employer has been paying it. And if your employer has been paying this $9,300 over the past 20 years or is going to over the next 20 years, that means he's actually paying you $186,000 that you're going to earn. You're going to make that $186,000. Your employer isn't going to pay 10 cents toward your hospitalization insurance. You can rest assured that isn't going to happen. Bill Gates may be a wonderful guy, but he ain't paying your health insurance. You're going to pay that out of your productivity. He might send the check off. He might negotiate the policy. They ain't going to pay a dime of it. Now, at the end of this 20 years, you're going to be down $186,000. If you practiced strict liability and at the same time practiced the 18 health laws of the Bible, you wouldn't get sick. Now, I don't have health insurance, and I haven't been sick in 20 years, and I'm not going to get sick for the next 20 years. And the reason I know that I'm not going to get sick for the next 20 years is because I practice those 18 health laws. So God came along and he said, I'll be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. I will take away from you all the diseases that I put onto the Egyptians. And if you lose anything practicing this law, I'll pay you 100 times the liquidated damages. So I said, well, no, I've got to make that choice, or I can make the choice that my government and Al Gore and George Bush and the rest of these people are saying, oh, no, no, you want to have national health insurance. Why, you don't want to rely upon God and these stupid health laws. Why, you know, you could be walking down the street and just inhale a polio virus and get polio. Or you could have an accident, or you could get hurt, and you'd have all these expenses. You better have insurance. You better not trust God. He's not very trustworthy. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, when was the last time God ever failed to perform on his half of the contract? Can you, any of you out there listening to me right now, point to one example where God has failed to perform on any contract obligation that he has obligated himself to over the last 3,300 years? Can you? I haven't been able to find any. In fact, he went so far as to say one time, he says, I keep covenant unto those that love me, keep my commandments to 1,000 generations. He said, I won't fail you. So I figured a guy that's smart enough to hang the moon out in orbit around the earth and start a big fire on the sun is probably a pretty smart guy. And I figured if he said, Gordon, this limited liability is a bunch of trash, and I don't want you practicing that. I want you practicing strict liability. I want you, Gordon, to personally be responsible for every dollar's worth of damage that you cause to somebody else. That'll keep you on your toes. By God, he's got a good point there. See, I used to have insurance, and then one day I was down at Jake's, there in Boise, you know, down at 5th and Idaho. Had dinner, had a few drinks. I was in there with Colin and some of the boys from Salt Lake City. And about midnight or so, we got time to break up and go home so we could get up and get our hell the next morning. And I was kind of drunk, and my old buddy, Colin Fryer, he said, George, you better take a cab home. I thought about it for a second, and I said, well, I tell you, I just live 16 blocks from here. And I've got a $500,000 insurance policy, $500,000. And I don't think I can cause $500,000 worth of damages in 16 blocks. So I went out, got my pickup, and drove home, and I was right again. Right again. I drove all the way home, didn't cause any damage at all, a whole lot less than $500,000 worth of damage, because I was fully insured. I mean, I had insurance coming out the yin-yang. Was that responsible behavior? I don't think so. But you know, I wasn't responsible anyway. The insurance company was responsible. I paid my $500 premium. My premium is paid. Paid my share. It's in the pool. Now today I don't have any insurance. And I'm driving down the road. And I'm approaching the Luty School District, and the sign says slow to 35. So I slow to 25. Because I want to have a little margin of safety, because I'm an old man now. And because I'm an old man, my reflexes are slow. That's what they tell me. My reflexes are slow. And the children that go to school there are a bunch of dumb hillbillies. And these dumb hillbillies are darting back and forth across the road, trying to find some old fart who's got slow reflexes so that they can get run over by him. I mean, that's the theory that goes behind this insurance. And so my eyes dart furtively from one side to the other, looking for dumb hillbilly kids trying to commit suicide by crossing the road in front of me to cause me to cash in on my insurance. Now, I don't have any insurance, so that means I got to buy every kid I kill. I got to personally buy them. Boy, that can get kind of pricey, especially under the law of Moses. He wants me to buy them from the bereaved parents. So you can trust me. I am very, very careful and very, very cognizant of dumb hillbilly kids trying to kill themselves running out in front of me. So I drive 25 instead of 35 to compensate for my slow reflexes. And I don't have any insurance, and I'm prepared to pay for every kid I kill. So far, I haven't killed any. And I'm also kind of counting on Big Mike to protect me from killing those kids. And it saves me a bundle of money. And instead of insurance, I have a property bond. And if you'll take a look in your state, you'll find that there's three ways for you to handle this. You can have insurance, or you can have an insurance bond, or you can have a personal recognizance bond. Personal recognizance is you put up your own collateral, as opposed to the insurance company that takes your premium. I think that if you were to practice strict liability with your own personal recognizance using your house or property as the bond, in fact, in most states, they have room for little religious groups of 25 people or more, and we'd have it in this state. 25 religious people can get together that don't want to practice limited liability, and they can practice strict liability by posting a bond with the Secretary of State or with the Department of Revenue. I forgot which here in Missouri, but just check that out, you know, for some crazy lunatics out there that don't want to pay this insurance premium, and all of a sudden, work out the numbers here for yourself. 32 years. I don't know what you're paying for insurance premiums, but here in the Midwest, it's about $600 a year. So take 600 times 32 years. You should pay $19,200 in premiums, and you should have one $1,835 accident. Let's take $1,800 divide that by 19,000. Oh, my God, that's 0.09473684.2%. You know, your chances of having an accident, you're going to pay in $1,835. You're going to collect 9% on average of the premiums that you pay in. The insurance company is going to collect about 90%. Sounds like to me that insurance is a pretty good racket. And if the insurance company doesn't believe you're going to have an accident, why should you believe you're going to have one? If the insurance company believes that your house is not going to burn down, why should you believe that it is going to burn down? Remember, the insurance company is taking the other side of your bet. So in a house like Boise, Idaho, where you're paying $500 a year in fire insurance, betting that your $100,000 house is going to burn to the ground, the insurance company is betting you $500 a year it isn't going to burn. Just test it. Did it burn down last year? Did it burn down the year before? 5 years ago? 10 years ago? When was the last time your house burned? And you've been paying that $500 a year every year. Well, there's on average in Boise, Idaho, one fire every week. 52 fires a year times $14,000. And that's $728,000. The insurance industry has 25,000 houses, not counting the businesses now, 25,000 times 500. Well, they're collecting 12,500,000 in paying out $750,000. pretty good odds, I'd say. And if the insurance company can work on those kind of odds, so can I. Think about it. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. And the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. That can be accessed through our website, and the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Sometimes people write me letters. I've received, now I've done this program on insurance more than once, and people sometimes they get kind of uppity with me. You know, they'll send a letter and say, where in the Bible does it say, thou shalt not have insurance? Well, no place. It doesn't say that any place in the Bible to my knowledge. And I've read the whole thing. So if you're looking for the spot that says, thou shalt not buy insurance, in fact, the word insurance doesn't apply or doesn't appear in the Bible at all. It's an English word that wasn't in vogue, evidently, back in Moses' day, so it's not there. However, in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36, let me just check that and make sure that's the right section. Sometimes I get a little mixed up with my Alzheimer's disease. And Exodus 21, verse 28, yep, if an ox gores a man or a woman and they die, the ox shall surely be stoned and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. And if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, if he is known to have pushed with his horn in time past, and it has been testified to his owner, and his owner has not kept him in, but he has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. See what I told you about the common law being brutal, harsh, nasty, scary? I mean, how would you like to be a farmer? I'm a farmer. I've got bulls down the lane here. And you're a student, and you come to school here, and one of my bulls comes out here and kills you. And what's worse is somebody comes to me and says, hey, did you know that bull's kind of mean? He tried to run over me. I had a bull like that some years back. He got a little testy. Guy got testy with me is what he did. So I gave him a number 9 overcoat with cellophane wrapping and tucked him away in the locker. And that's because I practice this law. And if that bull caused you a damage, I got to pay for it. So I'm very careful about my livestock and being very gentle and passive critters so that they don't harm any of you good people out there. So here's God, you know, the guy that hung the moon out there in orbit around the earth and started that big fire on the sun. You know, he comes along and says, hey, listen, you got a mean bull? Kill him. Because if you don't, I'm going to require that you die with him. Now, if there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatever is laid upon him. Well, what if somebody laid a ransom on my life of $1 million? Do I want to risk $1 million over one crummy bull? Now, this is what individual responsibility is all about. You see, with individual responsibility, and I sit here and I have to make a decision. Do I want to risk that bull harming one of you students coming to school? If I've got insurance, I sit back and say, I don't need to worry about it. I don't care if that bull runs over you and kills you or not, because I'm not responsible, the insurance company is. So if you want responsibility in society, you lay the responsibility right on the shoulders of the actors themselves. And it's true, there's going to be one once in a while that doesn't pay attention, and his bull goes out and harms somebody, and he loses everything he's got. And that's his payment for not practicing strict liability. He should have been alerted to that bull's bad behavior. The rest of us learn from those guys that make those mistakes. And that's kind of like some guy that's driving his car. I remember old Ronnie Cullen years back. You know, he had a 49 Merc. And back in the old days when I was a kid in school, a kid that was running around in a Mercury. You know, that was, he was in the top 400. Well, anyway, now David Wagner, he went under the Lolita underpass And he said it was marked at 35. He said he could go under there at 45, and so I could go under there with my 47 Plymouth at 45, pushing 50. And Ronnie said that he could do it at about 50, pushing 55, But Sapti hit the side of the underpass and wrecked his car. And that sent a signal to all the rest of us that there are physical limits beyond which we cannot go. Physical limits beyond which we can't go. So you learn from the mistakes of others. Now, sometimes some guy gets killed, and then you learn from the mistake of the guy that got killed. Don't do that. It's dangerous. Now, if the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto the master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And if a man shall open a pit, or if a man shall dig a pit, not cover it, and the ox or an ass falls therein, the owner of the pit shall make it good and give him money unto the owner of them, and the dead beast shall be his. Look at that. I dig a hole. And it's nighttime, and you walk into it. Clear-cut negligence, isn't it? Okay. Well, most of us have insurance, don't we? And the insurance guy comes along, and he reminds you of these negligent acts. And he tells you that you have to make these repairs and these changes. That's a guardian ward relationship. That's for people who can't think for themselves. That's for people who are irresponsible. People who have insurance are irresponsible. Now, how would you like to become responsible? I know, it's a big step. It's a wild new concept. Responsible people mark the hole, put barricades around it to make sure that people and animals don't fall into those holes. And if they fall in, well, then you got to pay for it. So maybe we ought not to be digging so many holes. Now, if one man's ox hurts another's ox, that he dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide the money of it, and the dead ox also they shall divide. Or if it be known that the ox is used to push in times past, and his owner has not kept him in, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead ox shall be his. That's again called negligence, contributory negligence. Now, here's the statute, in case you're going to write me a letter and say, where in the Bible does it tell you not to have insurance? Right there, it's Exodus 21, 28 through 36. Now, over here in Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and there's another statute that goes right along with this. Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, he says, you shall not add unto the word which I command you, and neither shall you diminish aught from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Eternal your God which I command you. So there's a statute. It says, now, Tommy, don't you add to that, and don't you take away from that. Don't you add a health insurance policy to that, or an auto insurance policy, or don't you take away from that. Don't you fail to perform under that statute that I give you, Tommy. All right. Then Jesus comes along in Matthew 4:4 for all of you New Testament freaks. You know, you guys that don't believe in the Old Testament. Okay. Well, here's Jesus in Matthew 4:4, and he said, man doesn't live by bread only, or by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. And Exodus 21, 28 through 36 are some of the words that proceeded out of the mouth of God. And Jesus cited that. Those words that he quoted there came from Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. He cited that right out of Moses. And at the time he made that citation, there wasn't a word of the New Testament that had been written yet. Boys and girls, all you religious guys that reject the Old Testament, not a word of this New Testament had been written yet. Nothing. Not a syllable. Not a letter. Not a period. Not an apostrophe. I just thought I'd rub it in a little bit because it needs to be rubbed in. All right, now we got that down pat. We complain a lot, but boys and girls, you and I are the proximate cause of our own injury. Don't get mad at God now. He told you. You know, the guy that was smart enough to hang the moon in orbit, he's a pretty smart guy. Doesn't have any letters after his name, though. He's not that smart. He's pretty smart, but he's not that smart. Believe it or not, God Almighty doesn't have any letters after his name. Damn high school dropout anyway. Tontine Insurance, 1868. Now, in order to evade the usury laws, which had prevented the growth of the funded system of national insurance, governments had frequently resorted to the issue of annuities and child endowments as a means of raising funds. The Tontine was a somewhat later development, having been put into operation in France during the year 1689. And it took its name from that of its originator, Lorenzo Tonti, a Neapolitan banker who was attracted to Paris by the regime of Mazarin and who introduced the system into France. In its original form, the Tontine was a loan in which the premium was never to be repaid, but the entire interest on the loan was to be divided each year among the survivors or the original subscribers. Boy, doesn't that just describe Social Security? Tontine wagering scheme, in which the premium was never to be repaid, but the entire interest on the loan was to be divided each year among the survivors or the original subscribers. That's what we call a Ponzi scheme. Now, the chief characteristic and trademark of Tontine is that the pool of assets is divided among the survivors at the option of those subscribers who dropped out or did not survive until the time for distribution had arrived. That's also a wagering policy, just like the George Rapp Harmony Society. Now, the Equitable Life Insurance Company in 1868 introduced the deferred dividend system, which was really an application of the Tontine principle. The most serious flaw in the deferred dividend system was the inability of the insured to compel an accounting. The general rule is that the policyholder is not entitled to compel the company to account for dividends, nor can the policyholder compel the distribution of the surplus fund in any other manner, at any time, or in any other amounts than provided for in the contract. All right, boys and girls, notice in the contract, when you sign up for insurance, you're signing up for admiralty. And that's because it's not a common law program. God hasn't got any law to regulate or govern insurance. So what we have here in its place, then, in place of strict liability, we have this insurance program. And in the case of Social Security, it's a Tontine wagering scheme. Tontine wagering scheme. It's a Ponzi scheme in which you get paid back less than you pay in. Well, unless, of course, you were some lucky guy. Now, we talked about the guy that pays in $550,000, draws out $150,000. Well, if you're drawing out $12,000 a year, and let's just divide that into $550,000, shall we? $550,000. And then let's just divide that by $12,000 a year. That takes 45.83 years. Or is it 458 years? Let me try that one again. 550 divided by 12. 45 years. Try it again. 45 times 12 is how much? 540. All right, so let's suppose you retire at age 65. If you were to live 45 years, you could collect everything that you paid in out. Let's see, you'd be 65, 75, 85, 95, 100, 510. If you lived to be 110 years old, you could get your money back. How many people do you know live to be 110? Well, boys and girls, the insurance industry is a master at figuring out what the odds are. And the reason that they offer this insurance, whether it's auto insurance, see, the auto insurance insurance companies, they all know that the average guy has one accident every 32 years, and that the average price of an accident is $1,835. Now, this is a few years old, might be up a little bit from that, but in round numbers, that's about correct. Once every 30 years, you're going to have an accident that costs $2,000. And so they price their premiums accordingly. And in some cities, it's $3,500 a year, like Los Angeles, and in rural areas like I'm living in, it's $500 a year. But on a nationwide average, I would imagine that the average driver in America is paying around $1,000 a year for auto insurance. And in 20 years, that's $20,000. So you pay in $20,000 and collect, in 30 years, you'd be paying in $30,000 and you'd collect two, 15 to one. Now, that's great profit. Insurance companies make wonderful profits. Not as good as farming profits, but it's good. It's fantastic. It's stupendous. Banking's number one, insurance is number two. Or actually, it's farming number one, banking number two, and insurance number three. Now, as stated in the report of the Armstrong Committee, the plan of deferring dividends for long periods has undoubtedly facilitated large accumulations, providing apparently abundant means for doubtful uses on the one hand, while concealing on the other hand the burden imposed upon the policyholders. Now, according to George L. Arnhine, instructor in insurance at the University of Pennsylvania, he said the deferred dividends were prohibited by law in the legislation of Pennsylvania of 1906 and subsequent years. Thus came to an end a system which in 1898 had superseded to a very large extent that of annual dividends and which in 1915 seemed antiquated. According to Mr. Arnhine, it was outlawed in 1906, but it didn't seem antiquated until 1915. John K. Tarbox, the Commissioner of Insurance for the state of Massachusetts, had this to say about Tontine in his annual report. He said, "The false idea of life insurance as investment begat the equally false conception of life insurance as a bet, and the latter gave birth to the modern Tontine, which is a wager. In the Tontine, the forfeitures go to enrich the individual survivors of the special class of policyholders who enter the compact, constituting a company liability instead of a company asset. For the protection of its policy obligations, the stake played for, rather than the game itself, constitutes the chief offense. Our law condemns, forbids, and makes void the contract of forfeiture. And as was truly testified before the committee of the New York Assembly in 1877, the Tontine policy is taken for purposes of investment by a set of men who would not insure their lives at all. The inducement to the investment is the expected profits from the forfeitures. And aside from the moral quality of the matter, concerning which I waive controversy, the considerations which the public aspect seems to me principally to invite are these. First, whether it's prudent to make of our insurance companies great banking establishments. And second, whether an institution organized as the life insurance system was for a benevolent and unselfish use and shall be combined with enterprises of selfish speculation as the Tontine undeniably is. And I'm strongly persuaded of the impolicy and the positive danger of magnifying the banking feature of life insurance institutions to accommodate modern plans of Tontine speculation and endowment investment. Now, insurance companies are opening banks. Did you know that? John Tarbox clearly stated that before 1900, there were modern plans to make insurance companies, specifically Tontine insurance companies, great banking institutions. Well, they're doing that now. They stopped it for a time, but just for a time. The Tontine scam had to have been declared unlawful in several states as the people knew that they had to do something to protect their money. Today we call it derivatives. And the paper money advocates then brought to the United States Paul Warburg, the son of one of the big banking families from Europe, from the House of Warburg, which dates back to the Hanseatic League of Merchants in 1536 in Hamburg, Germany. Warburg sold the American public on creating a Federal Reserve Bank so that there allegedly wouldn't be any more panics and depressions. In addition, he taught that such a system would be able to even out the economy by control of the money supply. And Warburg was successful. And by the Federal Reserve Act, the American people lost their sovereignty, lost their independence, and lost their common law. And the giving control of our credit and money supply to a private banking organization had the result of a complete and absolute surrender of our independence by transferring the control of the nation to the Federal Reserve. Now, boys and girls, all of this is done under admiralty. And notice that it doesn't have anything to do, in most cases, with ships or shipping or the Great Lakes or the Mississippi River. Admiralty has moved inland. Admiralty has moved in past the high water mark. Admiralty deals in contracts, and we want to deal in contracts. Admiralty deals in maritime insurance contracts, and boys and girls, we want to deal in maritime insurance contracts. And they're adjudicated in admiralty. We're the proximate cause of our own injuries. So don't get mad at God now. He told you not to do that. And you're the one that said, oh, no, God doesn't know what he's talking about. We're going to have insurance. We're going to practice limited liability. We're not going to be responsible for actions. Well, okay, if you're not going to be responsible, then your guardian will be responsible for you. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.